I want to thank Bruce and Yul for the opportunity to speak here today. I'm from Mass General, 1811 there, and I think John gave the first talk of this conference. He said that the motto of MGH, what did he say, we're old and we're proud of it. I'd like to point out, though, that MGH has moved forward quite a bit in the last 200 years since the horse and buggy slides that John showed. Our original building is shown here that was built in the 1820s, but we've recently added our brand new outpatient care facility, which is shown here, and our wonderful state-of-the-art ICU on the Bullfinch lawn there. So MGH is really moving forward. The role of the pathologist in the labs at MGH, we've played a central role for a long time. There's been pathologists at MGH since the 1840s, very early up when they put up the walls. The first pathologist is well known to most pathologists, really all pathologists, James Homer Wright, who was really the founder of the Wright stain and something that we still use today. I think right now we really are at a crux here, a fork in the road, where these new delivery models for healthcare that we've been hearing so much about over the last 2 days are really going to change the role of the pathologist. And it won't be changing it for the good unless we really make some changes in what we're doing in our laboratories. So clearly, from Health 2.0, Web 2.0, all the different ways looking at the pagers and Blackberries and cell phones in the audience, clearly the information-based society is here. And from a corporate perspective, from a healthcare perspective, from an individual perspective, the folks that are going to be the victors in this sort of war in the marketplace are those that are going to be able to identify, create value, evolve, and share their information assets. Information is all we really generate in a pathology department, so that's our main asset. And sharing it with the world is going to be very important. Why this is so important is because what happens in a hospital, it's really all decision-making. If you look at a hospital, what's going on is thousands and thousands of decisions are occurring every single day. And at the heart of all these decisions is an individual, and it's that individual's ability to process information. That's the weak link. As usual, the human is kind of the weak link in this picture, and we have to do, in pathology, as much we can to help that individual process that information and make those decisions. So clinical information systems have risen to fill this void in the last couple of decades. The emphasis has been on taking what we had in the paper world and moving it electronic. So now we can look at the echo in real time, we can see the EKG, we can see all the notes that everyone's written, but that really hasn't given much of a bang for the buck. That prior emphasis of making an electronic multimedia medical record has really not paid off in a very substantial way. The new emphasis is really, let's get some value out of this electronic medical record. A lot of the talks in today and tomorrow especially are really about, let's see if we can use this electronic record now to prevent errors, to improve actual value, outcome divided by price, to improve our utilization of resources, and to really create decision support at the point of care. So that's what I'm really going to be talking about today. The reason to paint such a dire picture is studies like this that show across the continuum of care, whether you're looking at acute care, chronic care, or preventative care, in the U.S., only 55% of our patients are getting the recommended basic level of care. And it doesn't matter whether you have great insurance or no insurance. You still get poor care in this country. And this paper really suggested that there's lack of really a coherent information model that underlies a lot of this issue. And they pointed out that patients that are in a mature information model, like some of the VA visions that have a mature information model, have a lot more success at making the recommended levels of care of 67% versus the 55%. Still very low and still really suggesting that we have a lot of work to do. So the overall healthcare goals, we're spending our $2.3 trillion to get to that 55% level of care. The goals are clearly to enhance value at the bottom line while improving patient safety and improving efficiency and quality. Those are the sort of the bottom line goals. So what has the lab been doing in the past decade to support these goals? We've been, you know, automating and centralizing our core laboratories, making sure we really understand workflow. I think everyone probably in this room has gone through a Lean and Six Sigma project in the last couple of years. And I think, not to denigrate them at all, I think they're wonderful tools for improving your laboratory. And then the third trend would be really the decentralization of point-of-care testing to the operating rooms, to the emergency rooms, and to the places where care is delivered on a minute-to-minute basis. But I think all of these, you know, laboratory trends that we've been involved in aren't necessarily going to further the goals that we have on the top here. So we really have to look at, you know, kind of what we're doing in the laboratory. So I think this truism is true, this thing I think we all accept. I don't think it's ever actually been published anywhere rigorously, but the statement that 60 to 80%, when I was trying to reference it in a paper once, I had to take it out because I could not find a reference, and not for lack of looking, for that statement. But I think while it's true, the future success is not assured for pathology in this new information marketplace, these new delivery models of care. And in order to really prevent becoming the guy who just delivers the result, who tells you what's on the slide and really being commoditized, I think we have to evolve. And so the rest of this talk is really going to be, you know, how to evolve a little bit. So if we look at our past and what we ask our clinicians about, our clinicians, when we survey our clinicians, what do they say? We want the pathology department to give us the correct result. We want it fast. We want you to be friendly on the phone. That's about it. Those are pretty low, you know, expectations to rise to. But that's, you know, that's what clinicians, quote unquote, want. I think, however, there's lots of people that are using pathology and laboratory data every day. So the order entry system, decision support, interpretive software, result viewing applications, personal patient medical records, all of these are heavily using pathology data, but none of them really want to own pathology data. So there's this definitely dynamic here and that we have to deal with. The general way that most folks deal with it is staying within the laboratory. So working on the things we do really well, bringing up new tests, automating our labs, leaning our labs, reducing turnaround times, all these things that have, you know, impacts, dramatic impacts within our lab, but less dramatic impacts on a sort of whole hospital or whole healthcare basis. So we spend a lot of time data warehousing and data exchanging, but less time on the more complex tests in our organization that really are get unmet right now in terms of really having pathologist input into things like ordering guidelines, patient and specimen ID, order entry decision support, analysis of complex data, and interpretation of complex data. These are the things that really get missed in pathology. So the question is, you know, how to jump into the deep end? We've been staying in the sort of the shallow end of the pool for a while. And I think the answer is very carefully to jump into the deep end here. We've got to realize there's numerous groups in our organization that are also doing pathology, also doing informatics. Informatics is not a new specialty. There's lots of medical informaticians around. So you'll usually have a decision support group, an order entry system, a results viewing, medication administration, radiology, and all these folks will be using pathology data in their systems. So the way to sort of succeed, I think, in this, and succeed in really anything, of course, is to bring value to the table and to really make it easier for these people that are all lining the banks here to do their jobs better, to really succeed. And that's, so we really want to think about how we can do that. And it's also important to realize that in the laboratory, just because we do the test doesn't necessarily mean we know everything about the test. Because we do tissue transglutaminase IgA, that doesn't mean we're the experts on celiac disease testing. So ordering guidelines, lab test order entry has to be a very much a collaborative effort to get it done right. So to do this, I think we go back to our lean concept. And I think the right person for pathology, for many of the key healthcare tasks in an organization is pathology. And I think pathology informatics can kind of rise to be this right person to curate and be the single source of truth for much of the data that drives a hospital. Lean is all about eliminating waste and maximizing the flow of information. And I think that's what we can do very well for our organizations. So Laszlo Barabasi, a scientist at Notre Dame for many years, or not very many years, he's only in his early 30s, he's a full professor, he devised this network theory that showed that a lot of things that we think of very complex systems in nature, whether it be healthcare, whether it be internet e-commerce, animal relationships, social networks, the molecules involved in cellular metabolism, they all can be described in this network topology that he's described with a scale-free network with multiple hubs. And this essentially describes what Yule's going to talk about and others are talking about tomorrow, really a federated system, where you have single sources of truth throughout your organization, and that information flows well to the center. So the goal for our hospital information network is to create hubs that can share information. And pathology informatics really can focus on cataloging, maintaining, and sharing knowledge. So what are our core competencies? I mean, that's one of the first questions to ask. What can we do for the organization? And some of the things are written here. You know, lab testing, of course, is one of our major hubs of any pathology department, but certainly decision support, interpretations, ordering guidelines, auto-identification, patient ID, these are all things that pathologists can do very well and things that aren't picked up very well by others in the organization. What the use of an information hub by Barabasi's work in all these systems is that they really provide a stability that's not there in other systems. They provide a single source of truth and a very efficient way to deliver things. So once you have this hub developed, you really have something that can stay robust and work for many, many years. So information processing in the laboratory testing process, very little of it is, you know, in my mind, goes on inside the lab itself. The analytics, as much as, you know, we've talked a lot about the middleware for analytics, and absolutely very important, but the stuff that's really going to have high impact is on the outside. It's the stuff that goes on before you even get the tube of blood. Did they order the correct test, and then can they interpret the test? And all the other little steps that have to happen in between. So we'll start at the beginning, ordering the lab test. And when we order a lab test, it's best to really just go back to basics. If you're sitting down, your clinician's sitting down, patients with them, seeking care, you have to think, okay, what can we influence? We have a very minimal set of things. We have this clinician's brain, and that's really our goal, is to influence what he's thinking at that moment. So we really have two options here. We can influence what's in their long-term memory, how much do they know about coagulation tests, for example, or immunology tests, or we can try to bring external memory to the table. We can give them, you know, a guidebook to help them order tests. We can give them order entry advice while they're ordering the tests. We can give them the past patient history, the data that might help them interpret the tests. If we think about the first one, you know, just educating our clinicians, this is what we spend a lot of our time doing. In pathologists, we're always asked to go to medical grand rounds or pediatric grand rounds and give a talk on coagulation testing. And so we do that, and we find it helps things for a few weeks, and then things quickly go back to baseline. The problem, of course, is that what any psychologist will tell you that from a systems perspective, human memory is largely non-modifiable. So as depressing as that is to all of us sitting in a lecture, at a systems perspective, if you're trying to change everybody's mind, trying to teach everybody how to order coagulation tests or immunology tests, that's going to be a loser. The effort required is not going to be helpful. The other thing is this knowledge performance gap. So even clinicians that know how to order laboratory tests, when faced in stressful situations or when you take away some of the choices, they make poor decisions. So there's this big knowledge performance gap that's sort of well documented in the literature. So we're going to use external memory. We're going to bring test information, testing guidelines, patient information, past test results, and interpretive info. So the question is how to do this. And of course, the key is to do this efficiently. You have to do this in the workflow of your clinicians. You have to really understand how people order lab tests at your institution. The content has to be centralized with a single source of truth. We really want to take that lean concept to heart of eliminating waste. So we really don't want multiple places handling these lab tests. And obviously, they can't be maintained by individuals because it's really got to be non-redundant. So when we think about order entry decision support, okay, picking the right test, there's lots of ways to help people pick the right test, and some of them are very basic, just what tests you put on your requisition, what reflex algorithms you have in your institution. Do you have a checkbox so when a clinician wants to work up an elevated PTT, they can just check a box. They don't have to remember that factor 12 is in the PTT pathway or any fact like that. Do you have an online handbook that provides information about what tests you do? The other part of this, computerized provider order entry, is really sort of the new thing that we can do to really influence test ordering. And I think it holds an enormous promise. I can just give one example of some guidelines that we put into our ICUs about a year ago. And what we found is we were really looking at redundant testing at that point. What we found is that we got a sustained 30% drop in test volumes coming out of our ICUs with just a simple fix of the ordering rules for ordering lab tests. And it's been a sustained 30% reduction in tests. And that's a huge number of tests just simply taken out. I think, you know, the analyzer vendors don't like that. But it's a huge number of tests, you know, taken out of the loop that are really completely unnecessary. So there's a lot to be gained here by giving information to clinicians. So we want to do this right. We want to eliminate waste. We want to flow information. But where to do this? Where to get this laboratory data? The LIS comes to mind. But the LIS, of course, was never designed to support picking the right test. You might have a couple of fields, you know, the test name, the alternate name, reference ranges that might be somewhat applicable, but it's really designed, it was designed, of course, and it does very well, supporting workflow and analyzer outputs. The LIS wasn't designed to support this higher level decision support. It does have this subset of knowledge that we need, so we don't want to throw that on the floor. One of the key concepts is to don't waste things, reuse knowledge. So we really do need to have the LIS as part of the solution. So I think we all know what the solution is, and we've talked about it multiple times in the last couple of days, and it's middleware. The middleware that's on the market now is mostly middleware that sits in between your LIS and your analyzers to help your lab, you know, function better. What we need is a middleware that really sits between our LIS and our order entry systems and all the rest of the world, because there's more to the world from an LIS perspective than who you're reporting to and who you're getting the results from, you know, the analyzer. So that's our need. We need middleware that's really the repository of decision support information. We need middleware that enhances the LIS capabilities but maintains a connection with it. When we change a test code in the LIS, when we change specimen requirements, we absolutely have to flow that information immediately to our provider order entry systems and our decision support systems. So we really need to incorporate all these lean concepts because we have lots of customers that demand this data, and they really need this data updated in at least near real-time status. So what we came up with is something we called Path Connect. It's just a very light layer of middleware that sits in between our LISs. Right now we've hooked it up to our Sunquest CPLIS, and we imagine hooking it up to PowerPath as well, where it aggregates the data and allows us to add more data. So it allows us to add all the fields we need to support order entry and decision support. So we can get the information out of our AP and CPLIS systems with simple SQL queries. We don't have to build a very complicated interface. And then we can aggregate it and do it in such a way that everyone understands it. Don't try to create a whole new standard for this, but do it using a service-oriented architecture and based on XML, so it's very flexible. So it can communicate with our inpatient provider order entry product, so it can communicate with our own lab handbook, so it can communicate with our clinical information system. So all this, you know, ripping off the Intel logo here, all the data that is actually driving order entry comes from the laboratory itself. We didn't hand over our data and say, you know, you take this data and run with it. We're giving them the data in near real time to work with. So the middleware is just really allows the cataloging of all the data needed for decision support in a way that it can be shared. So we create that service-oriented architecture that several people have talked about that really allows data exchange standardization. So not a rigid standard saying you have to put something in, you know, OBX field number 22 has to be this way and then it has to be followed by a caret, but a standard that everyone really understands. The developers understand web services, they understand how to work with XML, and that's the level of standard that we're using. So the laboratory order entry screen, I really like the expression that people are using, and I added this to the slide, that leaving the white space. So what we want our ancillaries to do is leave us white space. And if we're competent enough to fill in the white space, I think that white space will be left for us. So in this case, working with the provider order entry team, they left us the white space to fill it in with a lab test. So we fill in, you know, what the common lab tests are, the ordering messages, collection instructions, all this stuff that has to be maintained by the laboratory, since we're the ones, the real experts here, and the single source of truth. All of this stuff flows to our order entry application. And the key here is that this data has to be updated in near real time, and who is going to do that? The provider order entry team is worried about how to get the dietary orders done and the radiology done and the consults done. This really has to reside in the laboratory. So the order decision support does not have to mean, you know, dumb laboratory screens. We can have fairly sophisticated laboratory screens. This is a screen where we're the clinician's ordering a hypercoag panel, and we're asking them questions. And all this information, you know, what medications you're on, the medication list, all of it can be codified by the laboratory, updated in real time. So if there's a new medication that appears on the block, it can appear in our medication list in real time. The key is that for all the UI in these projects is built by the data underneath it. We have a very simple UI, and it gets built by the data underneath it. And that's sort of an important concept here, is to build software that gets smarter. So when I first came to MGH, one of the first quotes that I remembered from our longtime LIS director was, I've been at MGH for 30 years, and I've yet to see a project get to version 2. And just speaking to the point that we get pulled off on, you know, you do something and you're excited about it, and then getting to the next version. That's why we had those discussions this morning about, you know, how many versions can I be behind and still be okay. And that's a really important concept when you're buying software, unfortunately. So when you design systems, I think you really have to think about the underlying data model. And to buy a system or build a system, you really have to look for a system that can get better over time without you going to version 2. So it has a robust authoring tool. It has a robust data model that you can get at and have the intelligence of the system driven by the data model, not how many bells and whistles it has or how the colors look on the screen. That shouldn't be the intelligence of the system. The intelligence of the system should be developed by your data model. And then a second corollary to this is monitoring. If you don't know how users are really using your application, you're really at a disadvantage when you want to tweak things, when you want to change your data model to make it better. So monitoring tools really have to be in the data on day one. And I'll show some examples of kind of how that's been helpful to us. So once we've aggregated this data, we have this this middleware tool that takes all of our CPLIS data, and we've been able to augment it with all the fields we need. We then can use it for a whole variety of things, whether it's the enterprise-level decision support, our own laboratory handbook. We'll look at an example of the lab handbook. So with one stored procedure, SQL stored procedure, we can create a laboratory handbook, something that used to take, you know, a lot of effort. So we just have some ASP pages that get filled in with the data behind the scenes. So the essentials of a lab handbook, and I think they're absolutely essential for every, you know, organization to have one, because it's one of the simplest ways to let everyone know what your test menu is and start providing interpretive information and how to pick a test. It's got to be really easily accessible. We want to put it everywhere our clinician is. We want it one click away. That's our goal, is to have a single click from when they're reviewing a result, when they're ordering a lab test. We want this little info button that we have. You might have noticed it on the screen, the little I. That's one click away from the laboratory handbook. So we use this to really provide information. It has to be obviously locally updated and maintained by pathology as our single source of truth. And it's got to be smart. People type things into Google, and they expect to get the result. We have a much, much simpler task. We don't have, you know, billions of web pages. We have a few thousand lab tests. So if we can't figure out, you know, search terms and algorithms and make our searches very smart, we're really just not trying. So that can be done very easily. So here I've just typed in CMV. I get the results for CMV. I give information about this is the test of choice for blood. They can kind of keep clicking on and keep getting more information. So we'll give them ordering and interpretive information and then provide links to other web pages. I think it's important to realize that you don't have all the information about CMV. There's probably a good CDC site. There's probably a good PDF that one of your clinicians may have written up about it to really be the conduit for giving data to the entire hospital can be really important. So monitoring usage, again, is really important. If you're going to put out an application, you want to know that people are using it. You want to know who's using it, so we track. We can track by their login ID on the intranet kind of who's using our laboratory handbook. We can assess our marketing efforts. We gave little pens away with our URL for a while, and then we started slowly putting it on the various websites and connecting it to everything they do. And now we have hundreds and hundreds of users a day. And what we've seen is we get fewer calls to our customer service center. We used to be in the 8,000 or 9,000 range for phone calls to customer service, and now we're actually below 5,000 calls per month. People do not, as much as charming as we think we are, people do not want to talk to somebody on the phone to find out the correct tube or to find out the correct test or find out the turnaround time for a test. They want something accessible in their workflow to get that information. Monitoring searches. Anytime I think that you have an application where you're asking someone to look for something, if you have a strong data model behind the scenes, that's a real opportunity. You can collect that data, so exactly what was typed in the search engine. This is very similar to what Google does, right? It aggregates what people are searching for and makes things smarter. I mean, it has multiple ways that it gets smarter, but that's one of the ways. Here, we're looking at what percentage of searches led to zero results. So if you type in something and you misspell amoeba, you're probably going to get zero results. So that tells us, okay, people don't know how to spell, for one thing, which we knew that. But it also tells us we need more keywords, and so people can find our data. Good examples are things like tissue transglutaminase IgA, so the test for celiac disease. People don't tend to remember that, but they tend to remember celiac. So they're going to be searching for tests, not by test names, but often by diseases, by symptoms, and all of that has to be supported. And you can make this thing get smarter very quickly by just monitoring it. So the bottom line is try to build smart software, try to buy smart software. The user interface, you know, build it once and then use the data model to make it smarter. So that's computerized order entry and really the front end. The question is sort of what makes for a well-run lab, and I think you can find many very well-run labs with almost any vendor under the map that's actually in the laboratory, any automation system. I don't think it has very much to do with automation or vendor, which vendor you have. What makes for a well-run lab in many labs that I've seen is what's coming into the lab itself. Is it barcoded tubes that are, that have the patient registration information, have all the information? Is it correctly labeled tubes? Are the specimens all correctly labeled? And I think this is a really important part for pathology to play a role in. And so we've been really, because no one else is going to do this. No one else is going to make sure that your specimen is labeled correctly. Simple things, putting a barcode on a wristband and asking people to scan it for glucometry instead of hitting the keypads on the glucometer can have dramatic results. So we were on our 400,000 glucometry readings we were doing each a year, we were getting about a 1% to 3% error rate, and that dropped to essentially zero when people were scanning the barcode. So very simple things can make a big difference. Barcodes have been pretty much an abysmal failure in healthcare, though, and the places that use them really have to provide incentives. Usually the incentive is use it or else. To get people to use barcodes. If you look at sort of how the retail industry and how healthcare have implemented barcodes, retail did it right. They formed a standard. They had the UPC, so every, my Diet Coke here has the universal product code on it, and every supermarket product you buy will have that. They keep the workflow the same, things going past a checkout person, and if you make a mistake, there's a minor monetary consequence of error. And they can really monitor their success. They've got, they know their labor costs. I mean, the groceries are, a very well-run business in general. And so they can look at their increased customer and revenue growth. In healthcare, we don't have standards. There's barcodes on everything you buy, usually multiple barcodes. It used to be a 2D barcode, a 1D barcode, lots of different barcodes. We try to use them at the point of care. If we make a mistake, it can be devastating to a patient. So we really have to do things very cautiously, and the successes tend to be relatively nebulous, better patient care. I think we're finally getting to the point where people are really starting to use barcodes for everything. We're doing medication administration with barcodes. But what people are finding, of course, is that barcodes don't work very well when everything's moving. They work well in the laboratory because you have a stationary scanner and you're running tubes by it, but they don't work well in patient care areas where the nurse is moving, the patient's moving, lots of different moving parts. So the solution here is really to turn to other forms of auto identification technology. And one that I talked about last year at this conference, radio frequency identification, really holds a lot of promise in healthcare, especially on the specimen identification and specimen labeling front. So RFID is everywhere, and it's everywhere because it is so consumer friendly. I mean, we just recently in Boston switched our subway passes to RFID, and it's made a world of difference, not having tokens, not having things that people have to worry about. You just, you know, hold up your whole wallet and it reads your card through your wallet and you walk right through. So that sort of technology really needs to be adopted in healthcare. One example is in the blood bank at Mass General. Sunny Zeke is doing a project right now where he's got the ORs using RFID to improve the delivery of blood. So we have an RFID, a passive RFID tag on the blood bag. We have a passive RFID tag on the patient wristband. And there's an interrogator, a passive RFID reader, that both of these go by when you're going into the operating room. And then it just looks to see, do these medical record numbers match? Very simple system, but a system that will catches errors, because in a stressful operating room, when blood comes in, if it looks pretty close, you know, when the surgeon is screaming at the nurse to give blood, they're going to give the blood rather than do the very careful check. So these sorts of things can really have an impact in certain situations. So in this case, it alerts, you know, stop, no match. It makes a loud sound to really stop, create a timeout. The other aspect of RFID is not just what is something, this is, you know, blood with a patient ID, but where is something. So in the operating rooms at Mass General, all the operating rooms are now are fitted out with active RFID readers and active RFID tags. So these are much bigger tags. You see everyone walking around with them. They're about the size of a keychain. And every sort of high-value asset in the operating rooms is tagged. So whether it's a patient, surgical staff, the cleaning crew, equipment, the electrocautery machine, the ultrasound machine, all of these can be located on a map. So this is White 3, the surgical floor at Mass General, and you can see where equipment is, where people are, and where the patient is. Where this becomes valuable, so this is moderately valuable to know where your stuff is, but where it really becomes valuable is just like where the laboratory, you know, testing becomes valuable, when you start tweaking the data model. If you have a strong data model behind the scenes, then you can write a rule. You can write a simple rule, like when the tags of the surgeon leave OR38, automatically page the person to clean that operating room. Simple rules like that. If we need the ultrasound machine for the next case, alert the charge nurse who's going to go find that operating machine, ultrasound machine, and bring it to OR53. So simple rules have reduced the time between cases, and it really quickly turned from a pilot project to a project in for all the ORs, because it really allowed an extra case to be done every four cases, which is a huge amount of dollars into a hospital, considering, you know, 30% of your revenues are generally from your operating rooms. So the key, again, is you know, build the software, but have a strong, make sure you buy something or build something with a strong data model behind it, so you can constantly be writing rules and testing rules and not waiting for version 2 before you can do something, I think is one of the keys. The last thing I'll talk about here is interpretive software and interpretive services. And the reason that this is needed is because of this. A busy clinician has test results for their patients every few seconds. You see, you know, a busy internist will see 20 or 30 patients a day, order a whole panels of laboratory testing. So every few seconds, a result is coming across that they have to worry about at the end of the day or whenever they're reviewing their lab tests. And so for this example, it's our outpatient medical record. You can see this patient had a hypercoag workup, and they have a low protein S, free and antigenic form. So this is going to set off all kinds of questions. When I showed this screen to my wife, who's an internist, she gave me kind of a blank look. And that blank look is because these results, we're not recording this, are we? Oh, we are? Oh, that's bad. But the blank look comes from the questions that start popping into your head. You know, is this a false positive? Is this, you know, does my patient really have protein S deficiency? Does the patient have a risk of thrombosis now? Do they need to be put on a medication? Should I refer them to a hematologist, which will take time and be expensive? Should I, are blood products indicated here? What's the next test to really confirm this? Can these results be due to a medication or some other, you know, cause of a false positive here? So what we've been doing at the Mass General, and I think many people know the work of Mike LaPosada, who's really been the father of this movement to create interpretive paragraphs for complex testing. So whether you're ordering a complex coag test, immunology, hematology, toxicology, we're going to give you not only the test results, but in almost near real time, the same day as the test results come out, we're going to create an interpretive paragraph to help you understand the laboratory results. And we're going to give you, you know, it's going to be patient-specific. It's not going to be a canned comment. It'll be very much patient-specific, taking into account the past tests that have been done on the patient. So when you do interpretive services, if you do it for the right set of test codes, you can get paid for Medicare. Medicare has a list of CPTs that can be billed for by a 26 modifier. You can't set up a sodium interpretation service if you want to and get paid for it, but you can do some of the things that require real interpretive power. So Lyme immunoblots, very hard for clinicians to interpret. ANA testing, difficult for clinicians to interpret. We go after the things that are hard to interpret, whether or not they're necessarily paid by Medicare. But nonetheless, we do about 30,000 of these interpretations that are paid by Medicare, and it brings in about $900,000 per year in billings. The problem that we had very early on was to make this efficient, make this process efficient. And again, we're going to have to do what we've done, I think, in probably every other talk here, is turn to middleware to really get a little more out of our LIS. So we with our LIS here and our clinical information system, that's where the interpret quest comes from. But to really get the interpretation out and to interact with pathologists, we've built a little bit of middleware to make that happen. I'll just show you some of the screenshots from that. So you're logging into the middleware, and you're picking a case. This is obviously just a test database. We're getting a case here. This is a patient that is a 60-year-old male who's getting some coag testing done. We have, I'm just going to click to see the test a little better. We can see this patient has a factor V Leiden deficiency, most likely, with an activated protein C screen that's low and a low protein S. At this point, we would engage the software to help us. So we built a really, you know, pretty simple user interface to just, you know, you could just type in there with the interpretive comment. But having a data model behind the scenes that can get smarter, that can create more coded comments as we need them, we can then have the software start collecting, selecting comments. We generally don't use this because we want our residents to learn and actually our residents to do the work. But we've have worked sort of behind the scenes to get this to work. And the software will select comments based on the labs, what it knows about the patient, the past history of that interpreter's of comment use in general for similar labs like this, and who the interpreter is. So with one click, you can create the interpretive comment, and then the job of the pathologist is really to validate if this comment makes sense, and if it doesn't make sense, to correct it. The iterative nature of this is if you correct it, that's going to send a signal to the software that something's wrong with the algorithm, and it'll store that fact that a pathologist made a change to it, and we'll be able to, you know, make the rules a little smarter, create another coded comment, et cetera. This is very similar to the sort of the products that Intuitive and PKS, which are both here today, are creating. I think this is a whole category of products that the clinical lab really needs. I think we're going to have to, with testing getting more complex, we're going to have to give some guidance to our clinicians. So here our pathologist just signs off on it, and it's immediately available. So it's available. So when my wife looks at her laboratory test, she doesn't give me that blank look. She's able to just read the interpretive paragraph, in this case written by Mike LaPosada, which describes what these low protein S values actually mean to the patient here. The other side of things, what I've talked about a little bit, is keeping things always one click away from where your clinician's at. So this is an example. That little I is our info button. And so if you're thinking about this functional protein S level, you're always just one click away from help. So in this place, you click it, you go to the laboratory handbook, you can read what we have, sort of interpretive information, read a monograph that one of the clotters has written. You can also go to lots of other sources of data. I think it's important to realize that we don't have all the data, so you want to have, you know, we have the ARUP consult guide, we have Clini guide, lots of different things are present in Knowledge Link that we want to link to. We want to make it easy to find data. And that's really one of the keys here. So to sum up, I think to evolve as a specialty, we have to improve our basic ability to deliver information. I think just, you know, sending the HL7 message to the longitudinal medical record is not going to be sufficient very much longer. if we kind of want to remain relevant in our organizations. And so developing these data models that I think are going to be talked extensively tomorrow that really permit this active knowledge sharing and rapid improvement cycles are really the way to go. A single source of truth, people that care about the data, that are maintaining the data, not passing off a whole series of data to people that have other things to do. So I think that's one of the keys here. And I think it's really a just-in-time strategy. So the key to success is to bake knowledge into the jobs of highly skilled workers to make it so readily accessible that it can't be avoided. I think we will all avoid knowledge at all cost if it's hard to get. So making things very easy to get is really essential here. So I just want to thank you for your attention.